Alrighty. So I think we're gonna do a little panel discussion. I think they're just gonna be answering questions. So if anyone has a question, you can line up right here. And maybe we should have our speakers introduce themselves again.
Sean Faircloth, Director of Strategy and Policy with the Richard Dawkins Foundation.
Ellery Shamp, long-time interest in separation of church and state.
Andrew Seidel, Constitutional Consultant for the Freedom from Religion Foundation.
Annie Laurie Gaylord, Godless Infidel.
All right, so once again, if you have any questions, like, you could come to this area right here where no one's standing. So,
okay. I don't think we're being that effective at communicating exactly how. I think people just think that we're overblowing the problem a little bit, and I think we need to be more clear that there is a problem, and it is based in religious thought, basically. Is there anywhere we can go, or we have, like, on the internet, like, maybe the Richard Dawkins Foundation, where, like, the 10-point vision is actually tied in with exactly what causes us to think that we need a 10-point vision, for example? And I know it seems pretty self-evident when you read the actual things, but am I not being clear, I guess?
Well, if I understand your question, that's a good idea, and maybe it should be put online. I mean, a lot of the greater detail for it is in, can you hear okay in the back? Yeah. A lot of the greater detail for it's in my book, but maybe it's a smart idea, and, you know, I know that certainly the other folks in this panel have well articulated many of the underlying issues related to that. What I hope that the 10-point vision does is kind of concisely summarize and turn it into a positive approach,
right?
But that nonetheless is addressing specific underlying injustices. But summarizing those or taking some of those things and putting them online in an easy, concise way seems like a really good suggestion to me.
Yeah, I just wanted to suggest that as sort of reference point that we can always just refer back to show how. I never even knew about all these cases that you mentioned. I forget your name. I apologize. But that's the kind of issue I think we're having trouble communicating because we don't have a sort of reference point.
So. Well, if you think that there's no trouble, I mean, you haven't been paying attention to what Rick Santorum has said.
Oh, no, yeah, I can see that.
But he's not, unfortunately, all that unique. I mean, Newt Gingrich, Romney, they've all said things that are very mm-hmm. inimical to the idea of separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. And look, what is going to be the alternative? Do we want unelected religious leaders? Do we want the Catholic bishops to be defining the policies and the laws of this country? I mean, I think that would be a horrible thought. And, you know, we've said that our non-believer membership is growing. All right, so we're 15% of the population. Well, 15% maybe doesn't sound so much. But 15% means there's 45 million of us, right? But we don't, we hear politicians talking about the Jewish vote, the Catholic vote, this vote, that vote. You never hear anybody talking about the atheist vote. So I think we ought to make it very clear that we're non-believers and we vote. And we deserve a... Now, there's one reason, of course, that there's a little bit of overlap between these progressive liberal types here and Democrats. So maybe we don't get separated out as a separate voting bloc. But we ought to be recognized as a separate voting bloc. And I think it's very important that we pull together behind something like the Richard Dawkins Foundation, because otherwise we get splintered. There's two or three different atheist groups. There's a couple of humanist groups. There's Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Freedom from Religion Foundation. And if we don't all pull together, we're all going to lose.
Thank you.
I would just like to say the one thing you could do would be to join the Freedom from Religion Foundation. We've had, so far this year, over 700 state church complaints. that's got to be a fraction of what is actually happening in this country. I would bet there's 100 times more than that happening. And if you want to stay informed and figure out how to fight these things, you got to get involved. You got to join up.
Yeah, and I would agree that nobody is wooing us, and it is time. And FFRF has a pin, I'm secular and I vote. I don't think it matters whether we're all under one umbrella. I think it's healthy and great and vibrant that there are so many of us and so many groups, and some of us have slightly different perspectives. It's great. It's healthy. But just get active. Doesn't really matter which group you like and you get involved in, but do something. If to that young man who said, I'm not sure what the problem is, if the Catholic bishops can take away contraceptive coverage for women in this country, I think that's a problem. I don't see a bigger problem that we could have right now.
I think it would be a great idea for people to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation and all the different national groups. I think that's critically important. Another thing that I'd really like to emphasize, given the audience here, is that young people in particular, when you talk about what's the problem, is to really consider running for office yourself. And sometimes I think people, when they're not that involved in politics, they say, well, we're going to run somebody for president. Well, maybe you run for somebody for president, but that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about running for the school board, for the legislature, for the city council, and building your way up. And frankly, and some people may disagree with me on this, I don't think you run and say, I don't believe in God, vote for me. I'd be offended, frankly, if somebody said, I believe in Jesus, vote for me. I find that offensive. But I think if you say, I do a good job in the school board, I take care of what's going on, I base my decisions on the merits, and we'll take an evidence-based approach to all the public policy issues, and that just like George Clooney, just like Brad Pitt, just like Warren Buffett, just like Bill Gates, you happen to not be religious, but you're a responsible and reasonable person, you can be very persuasive. And I think that the young people here in this room, that it is quite possible that one of you, or at least one of your generation, could be an elected non-theist president of the United States, but it requires rolling up first up that process, and that means you folks actually thinking about doing it yourselves.
Hi. Thank you guys for coming. I really appreciate you guys coming and speaking. It kind of seems like we're going a little bit backwards in terms of women's rights and abortion. I was wondering if you guys have a theory on why we're kind of stepping back, and then if there's any specific projects that you guys are working on specifically that kind of help to fight that.
Well, I think the feminist groups are working really hard, and seculars must support them, but I think it's the Tea Party pushback right now. I mean, the different legislation that is going on in Wisconsin and in all the other states is this pushback, and it's almost unbelievable, and we are starting to see the fundamentalists disassociating themselves from their support of contraceptive rights, joining the Catholic Church, so they're working in concert together, so it's very dangerous. I've been an abortion rights activist since I was a teenager. People say atheists don't start charities. My mother has been a volunteer running the Women's Medical Fund, abortion rights charity here in Wisconsin, which has paid for abortions for more than 20,000 women without means, because we have a Medicaid cutoff because of the Catholic Church. We have a federal cutoff because of the Catholic Church and the Hyde Amendment. If you want to help charity that's a pure charity, all the money goes to pay for abortions. The Women's Medical Fund is there. I think the feminist groups are there. Join them, fight with them. I think there'll be a lawsuit coming down in Wisconsin over the recent cutoff of Medicaid or medical fund abortion. But it is kind of a war against women, and there were rallies around the country today to fight the war against women. So I think there'll be a lot of opportunity for everyone to get involved.
Part of the reason I think you're seeing so much of it lately also is because it's an election year. These people propose these ridiculous laws, and then they can go back to their hardcore Tea Party or constituents and say, look what I got, or look what I proposed. So I think that's part of the reason it seems so bad right now, and it'll die off, hopefully, after the election cycle.
I want to sound a couple of cautionary notes about this issue, because I hear people, including secular folks say, sure glad that Rick Santorum lost. And I guess I'm glad Rick Santorum lost. But I will say, however, that I do a talk, it's on YouTube, Why Romney's Religion Matters, and I always thought Romney was going to be the likely nominee, and I think his views are much more subtle and in some ways potentially much more dangerous because I think he's potentially more effective. I don't know whether he's going to win this election in the fall or not, but I encourage people to consider that about him and assess where he's coming from with regard to issues because I think it's a lot more problematic than people perceive. The second thing that I think is more problematic than people perceive is let's assume for the sake of this discussion that Barack Obama wins this election in November. I think you'll see a lot of people saying, wasn't that great? Barack Obama won the election, so everything is sweetness and light. And I would encourage people to consider the ground leveler, whoever made that comment about the laws not going away. In my book, I document state after state and also the federal government, laws on the books. And the fact that Barack Obama gets reelected, which more reassuring than the alternative, I would grant you, but that those laws and most, the vast majority of those fundamental, I have a chapter in my book called The Fundamentalist 50, which outlines some of the most extreme fundamentalists who are sitting in elective office, the vast majority of them will win re-election in November. They will still be there. They will still have their hands at the lever of government. I think a lot of times it's understandable, but society tends to say, what's happening in the presidential race? And that's very important. But they ignore the legislatures where so many laws are passed and Congress where so many laws are passed. So I encourage people to really consider that ground level and to remember if, for example, Barack Obama wins in November, that our effort is far from over and the threat to women's rights and the entire range of theocratic viewpoints is still going to be a very live issue, and don't let people tell you otherwise.
Okay, so if we have an issue, we have a debate with fundamentalists about an issue, we can throw JT at him and he'll tear him a new one and, you know, game over, right? So if the issue is logic, if it's something that can be decided by reason, we got them. But for many, reason isn't the issue. I mean, they already know, right? As a strategic matter, going at this for policy, how do we fight that? What can we do when somebody says, well, you know, if you're godless, I just know you're wrong?
I mentioned briefly that we need to, and Sean reinforced this, that framing is everything. That the way we talk about the problems, the way we talk about the issues, the way we tell a narrative, a story, an anecdote, these are ideas that George Lakoff at the University of California in Berkeley has been presenting in a series of books. They are too infrequently read. Nobody is really appreciating the importance of what Lakoff has discovered in terms of the way the human mind works and the way that people's opinions get changed. There's a new book that I've just started reading by Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, called The Righteous Mind, thank you. Again, all these new discoveries from neuroscience have been really quite astonishing in terms of how we understand how our message is conveyed and how it's heard by the other side. So all I can say is that we've fallen down in not taking advantage of what is now much better known. And there's tools out there that make us a great deal more effective, and we're not using them, and that's very sad. I mentioned briefly the way we allowed the government allowed the Catholic bishops to frame the story about contraception and abortion in terms of religious religious freedom. Once they had seized that ground, it was almost impossible to dislodge them. That was a grave mistake. It should have been framed in the form of religious control over our lives, and whether there should be exemptions from, if the idea of non-discrimination in employment is a universal good, then we shouldn't allow exemptions for it. And so that's a mistake to get stuck in that position to start with. So framing, think about how it, I mean, everybody has different values, and you can appeal to fairness, for example. I know, for example, that you can't convince an audience that the idea of separation of church and state is good. You can convince them, though, that we have to be fair to people. And that often wins the argument.
So how do you convince people who don't subject their ideas to reason is kind of what it sounds like you're asking. And I think Sean talked about this a little bit earlier, and Hitchens was the king of this, is faith is not a virtue. And you have to attack faith as an ideal. I mean, faith is and has always been humanity's greatest liability. And I think that's what you need to go after, and we need to be doing that more. We have all these logical arguments about why there's not a God, but faith itself really boils down to the problem, because when your logical arguments win, they're left with their faith. And so we need to be pointing that out more, I think.
I would like to say that it is kind of sad, but separation of church and state is not really a sexy issue. Most people tune out. It's not, you know, we had a great commercial there, but it didn't have enough edge, probably. I mean, we couldn't be political. But I think I'm repeating myself, but the OUT campaign, the idea that you are coming out as an atheist, is the easiest thing you can do and the best way to change the world. If somebody says, bless you when you sneeze, and you say that's a funny thing to say to an atheist, you may have changed somebody's whole outlook, that you're a nice person at least, you're a colleague they know. I don't think that can be, we shouldn't dismiss that, and that is more emotional. That's people to people. The second thing, though, is state church. Every time there is a lie, a distortion, a historical myth that we are a Christian nation, we do have to rebut it. I don't know how you do that without reason, but it's perseverance, putting enough spaghetti on the wall, never letting them get away with anything.
I talked a little bit about it today, but on that talk, Atheism, a New Strategy, I really talk about storytelling and the way of framing our issues, and I think that is central to what we do. And I do think it's sort of a point of pride among secular people to say, well, we're going to get a bunch of spreadsheets and it'll be decided that way. And it's comforting because that is the right way in the most idealistic sense. But I think that anecdotes, stories, is critically important, and that when you tell one human story, I have focused on a story about a child who died in a religious child care, another died in a faith healing home. These are simply anecdotes. But on the other hand, I think they work, that they are effective to drawing people into the story, because then they're thinking more about, oh, I don't want that child to die in that way. And then you hit them with what the statutory framework that at least facilitates or makes it easier for that kind of thing to happen. And I think we need to take that approach much more often.
Hi, my name is Holly, and I, up until just a little over a year ago, was a fundamentalist Christian, so a lot has changed since then, but for the good. Fundamentalism is an interesting word. I never would have used it as a Christian, and I think that there's a spectrum of fundamentalism. I don't think I was extreme, but it does still seem extreme to me now. But I was raised in an environment where the words secular or secularism and the words humanist were both considered four-letter words. They were both considered terrible things. That's what was preached to me. That's what was taught to me in my schools, which is really hard probably for a lot of people in here to even wrap their minds around how those could be bad things. And it's hard for me to understand now that I understand them. But they're framed in churches and in Christian schools to children that they have to do with selfishness, which that's the opposite, and you know, serving oneself and being self-centered. And what I'm gonna do personally is, as I am talking to people, break down those misconceptions. I think we can all do that ourselves as we come across people. But my question to you is, have any of you encountered that kind of feedback directly when you're using those words? And they're great words, I know that now, but I didn't then, and I think there's a barrier there. People don't understand, and they're being taught lies about what those values really encompass. Thank you.
Any others want to address that more? I don't want to comment so much as ask, or I could ask you later, but I'm just curious about your transformation. I have never been religious. I wasn't religious when I was 12, 13. I became even less religious when I did Inherit the Wind in high school, you know, in the high school play. But I was always not someone who embraced any of that. So it's a little bit alien to me. And I'm always curious because I am pleased every time I travel to different communities, I meet people who say, yep, I used to be fundamentalist, and it changed. And so I always want to learn from you because I admire you for doing what you did. But also I'm interested about you had this one viewpoint and what were sort of the mechanisms where you ended up with what is a rather different worldview, which I know is an answer to your question, but just it interests me.
I'll try and be really brief because obviously it's a really long story, but the highlights are I actually took my faith really seriously, and a lot of times you hear those stories, like the people who are going to seminary who are the ones who end up becoming atheists. I wasn't going to seminary, but I took it really seriously. And for some reason, all of a sudden, the concept of hell started bothering me, and it never had before. I'd grown up with it, and it just started getting under my skin, and I made a fatal mistake. I tend to be curious, but I would keep blinders on when it came to my faith specifically. And if I had a question throughout the years, I would go and look at Christian apologetic literature. I wouldn't go outside of that bubble. And so I would find answers from different Christian apologists. And when the hell thing really started to bother me back in February of 2011, I made the fatal mistake of looking over the fence and actually looking at outside viewpoints on it. And I started reading up on it. And within a very short period of time, all the walls just came crumbling down, and I realized this is an illusion, essentially. And I know that seems crazy that it would have happened that fast, but there was a lot of cognitive dissonance over the years that I would just suppress and suppress and suppress, and it finally just, you know, hit the fan.
The religionists have been extremely effective in promoting the idea that without God, we're all going to turn into wild, raving maniacs. There will be no morality, no decency, no civilization. They've sold that idea with tremendous good effect. Now,